Good? Okay. Cool. Are we on? Live? Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, it was good talking to you about Mexican food from California.
Great.
I was trying to figure out the last time I saw you. I know you from undergrad, from UC Santa Barbara. 2006?
Yeah. I mean, what was your freshman year? Like 02 or?
2002.
2002. Yeah. So that was my freshman year too. So yeah, we were right from the start. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I see you have this beautiful plant shop down the street and I read about, and I was like, hey, I know you. This is amazing.
Yeah. That's great.
So thank you for doing the podcast.
Of course.
So take me through that. You know, you're at UC Santa Barbara like me. You end up in Portland. We're both in Portland now, which is great. What all happened in between and how do you get to today where you are a co-owner of a really cool plant shop?
Yeah, so it's a little bit kind of a long journey. So
I'm here for it.
Yeah. Great. And it is interesting because I don't think it happens to a lot of people. So basically, when I was in college in UC Santa Barbara, at one point, going through the dorm and then living, with my friends in student residential housing outside of the campus. And at one point, one of my friends was living in a student co-op. And at the time I'm like, what is a student co-op? I've never even heard of it, And all I knew was that it had really cheap rent and they throw really good parties. And I'm like, that sounds perfect. And there were like 18 people living in it. And I'm like, oh, that's, I'm not someone who shy away from that. To me, that sounds like, oh, that means bigger parties. That sounds great, So I was immediately drawn to it. I went, visited it. And at the time, my friend, was living in it. And instantly I was like, I'm going to apply next year. And this house is called the Biko House. Shout out to the Biko House, if anybody's listening from that house. And that kind of started my journey into essentially cooperative living and cooperative movement, cooperative lifestyle, if you will. For people who don't know what that means, and a co-op essentially is a horizontal governance of something. So a cooperative housing would be like something, a house that's governed by all of its residents in an equal capacity. So it's like a democracy. But in a house. And later on, pretty much like after the first year of living in the Biko House, I basically decided like, this is my lifelong dream. I'm going to try to start as many co-ops as I can. And at the time I was only thinking in like housing co-ops, and that kind of went on for a while. I lived in Biko for a while until I graduated. And after I graduated, I moved to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, but mostly in Berkeley, and continued to live in co-ops there. Basically adult, postgraduate, just like professional housing co-ops. And there is a house, another shout out to Fort Awesome. It's a pretty awesome name for a co-op. That was a 14 person house. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot from all of those communal experiences because it's essentially a kind of microcosm of like how the world could work. And you get to see kind of the, how certain things is how democracy kind of like come together in a way that's beneficial, but also there are barriers, there are like conflicts and drama and like intrinsic issues that arises in like even a very small scale democracy. And I learned a lot in that, but I was still a believer. And eventually I met my partner, Lotus, in Berkeley, just through friends of friends, and we were somehow were both very into just nature and this idea of communal living. And when we moved together and got married, and, you know, moved to Portland, and our goal was essentially, okay, we're going to start another co-op in Portland. And we basically, after 2 years of living in Portland, we house hunting and all of that, and bought a house in Foster Pound neighborhood. And that kind of, we were specifically aiming for a house that had like a lot of space that can turn into like communal spaces, but also bedrooms. And that house ended up being a 10 bedroom house with like two kitchen, two living room, two dining room, a big backyard, and just basically aiming for that self-sustaining community cooperative kind of model. And while we were going through, you know, establishing this new community, there were, of course, you know, hurdles and difficulties. But at around year two, one of our new housemate, her name is Nutmeg, moved in, and it was pretty immediately, it was very clear Nutmeg is like here to stay. And Nutmeg is, you know, just like a very much kind of a aligned in ideologies and passion, but also just a very good gardener. And she was, you know, trained horticulturalist, but also have been doing landscaping, specifically ecological landscaping business on her own. And we basically kind of work on that garden together at our house. And after about a year or two, to give you a little bit other background. So throughout like my adulthood, like my kind of like professional career is in business consulting and tech consulting. So I love talking to other people about their business, kind of like you. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to, you know, Nutmeg about her landscaping business every now and then. And the more I talked to her about it, the more I realized, oh, you know what? This is a very, very like growing trend, and it could be really big. And she's just doing it on her own, without any marketing, without like literally nothing. Like she basically just make a post on Nextdoor and she gets enough client for the whole year. And I'm like, okay, that's a good sign for a business. And so,
and is what she does, is it helping other people create a sustainable living model? So maybe creating a garden where they can eat the food that they're growing. Is that kind of along the lines of what she does?
Yeah. So let me kind of define what I mean by ecological landscaping a little bit. It's generally like the simplest way to think about it is like something that benefit the people and the planet. And that's could be a combination of edible landscapes and native landscapes. So native plants tend to be very helpful for the planet, because these are plants that's been evolved for tens of thousands of years in the local environment. So it grows really easily without a lot of input, without a lot of like fertilizers, pesticides, but also it attracts wildlife, it creates habitat. And then obviously edible plants are great for human. So that combination is essentially what we mean by ecological landscape. And of course, what we do is we try to, what Nutmeg at the time do is try to create that kind of landscape that are relatively easy to maintain for the homeowners and essentially aiming to create a micro ecosystem that kind of sustains on its own to some degree. And of course, you still need the human to kind of intervene and maintain and cultivate it, because you are in an urban lot. You're not just like out there in a forest where things kind of just like can self-maintain a little bit better, because there is a larger infrastructure of the forest. So that's kind of what I mean by ecological landscape. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Would that involve some sort of irrigation system or rain barrels or, you know, capturing water and then using that water?
That's a great question. So native plants tend not to need additional irrigation if they're placed in the right location of a landscape, mainly because nature doesn't irrigate other than, you know, the rain cycles that naturally occurs. But edible plants, because they're often, you know, conventional edible plants that are edible for human, right? Lots of plants are edible for a lot of other beings. Conventional edible plants for human tends to be like non-native to the region. So that means it requires special care and requires additional irrigation. But depending on how you set up the system, it's still, if you set it up in a way that's like a, what we call like a food forest. So you have different layers of like plants that creates symbiotic relationships that kind of support all of the edible plants in a way that you still need to kind of do a little bit maintenance here and there. You still need to like kind of cultivate it like in the first like 3 to 4 years. Then after that, once it's established, once the forest is established, it's a lot easier for it to kind of just grow on its own and, you know, provide the abundance. But of course, like if you want to kind of maximize, you know, the yields and things like that, then you want to kind of like be more kind of selective about how you prune things. But even if you don't do it, it's still going to grow and it's still going to self-sustain just fine. But you might not like how it looks. You might not like, you know, the amount of produce that it creates. But yeah.
So I appreciate you explaining all that because it gives background, but also a lot of people are not really familiar with some of these things. If I were to say to you, you know, what is the difference between having 10 roommates or having a co-op, what would be the defining factor? Is it sharing resources? Is it, tell me more about that. Like what makes a co-op a co-op?
That's a great question. And it's something that a lot of people ask me and they phrase it differently. You know, some people are like, what is a community, right? And I personally have my own definition because everyone have their kind of their own definition, even for people who have lived through them. Sharing of resource is pretty important. And I would also say on top of that, a sharing of values and goals. And those two things are kind of the foundational things that if you want to get into it with me, something else that's kind of a side project of mine is essentially creating a interdisciplinary like system science perspective of like what creates a sustainable system, whether that's a community, whether that's a business, whether that's a city or a planet, right? So for a community, like I said, you know, the two basic foundation is shared resource and shared goal. And that's how I would define a community or a co-op.
So you're in Portland and I saw a photo of your house. I think it's on your website. You're inspired. You have, it looks like the house, there is a garden there, but it's more than a garden. It's an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it come about that you and your partner decided, or maybe you, your partner Nutmeg, okay, we're going to open this into a business and we're going to start Symbiop. What was the impetus for that?
Yeah. So, at around like the beginning of like late, I want to say 2019 and early 2020, like we were talking more and more about like, oh, you know, it'll be cool to kind of expand the business. You know, we can create a team so that Nutmeg can focus more on just like creating designs and not get bogged down into like administrative things, you know, taking phone calls and like, and sometimes like implementing the design. And and then the pandemic hits, and you know, around February and March. And then at one point, basically a lot of our housemates and friends outside of the house like got laid off. And we were like, well, you know what, let's just do it. Let's just incorporate, let's create a worker cooperative. So essentially a company that's worker owned and worker run. And let's see how it goes, you know, like, and we basically kind of just like shot in the dark. And so it started with like, just like myself, my partner Lotus, and Nutmeg, three of us. We recruited a few housemates who lost their job as like just, you know, laborer for implementing landscapes. We added on like another designer, Matt, about 6 months in, and then added, you know, other friends like Kalila and like, you know, and I mean, I can name so many people. But basically, you know, we have grown from that to now, you know, we have close to 30 workers. But of course, you know, in the middle of it, we also opened up a garden shop, which is kind of a part of the story, but, you know, it adds to the complexity of all of that journey.
So there is the landscaping and design component, and then there's also the brick and mortar shop on Southeast Powell, which has a great of native plant selection, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. And so how did that come about? Is it that the brick and mortar came about after it was like, we have an opportunity to have a shop? Of course, it's daring in the middle of a pandemic, opening a commercial space.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, starting one business was already kind of risky in the middle of the pandemic. It turned out pretty well. We were able to break even within the first year. And starting a second business, essentially, a garden shop, pretty much a year after is just unthinkable. Like we weren't planning that. We were planning to open up a garden shop eventually, but we were thinking like, oh, maybe like best case scenario, 3 year down the road, if not five, right? But what happened was in around, again, you know, February and March 2021, a year after we started the landscaping business, we found out that Naomi's, Farm Supply, which used to reside in the same building, was also a place that I used to shop at. They were closing, and I, you know, my light bulb immediately kind of light up. I was like, oh, why do they need to close? It's a perfectly fine business. They were doing great. People loved them. Why do they need to close? So I basically like reach out to Naomi and like, you know, try to figure out a way to kind of get that going. And, you know, like, and for me as someone who, again, my lifelong goal is to create more cooperative. So expanding a co-op is part of that. So I'm like, yeah, it would be great if we can kind of keep the business going and then kind of just convert that into a co-op. But the business deal, unfortunately, didn't go through because we were basically trying to like get money from cooperative banks, trying to buy that business, and then trying to like keep all of the existing employees and turn that into part of our co-op. But that business deal didn't go through. And, you know, at some point we were, you know, pretty disappointed. But also, you know, our team are just full of really motivated people. And they were just like, they were the one who kind of convinced, you know, like the rest of us, just like, you know what, we can do it. We can start from scratch again. It's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be, everyone's going to be overworked for another year. So we kind of like scramble some money together and just like, talked to the landlord, kind of like, you know, kind of started a new lease and you know, renovate the entire place. It doesn't look like anything.
Yeah, it does look very different. And the art is beautiful as well. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we're pretty happy in terms of how it's turning out, you know, and it's slightly different business model too, because we're focusing again more on native plants and edible plants. I think there were some native plants that Naomi sell, but that wasn't their focus initially.
So they shut down their business. The landlord needed a tenant and potentially was probably, even though there's a lot of renovation, it was set up to be a nursery.
Exactly. Right?
So there's probably, I would hope or imagine, things that were there that were good for opening another nursery.
Yeah, it was definitely set up in a way that made it very easy to just have another garden shop business. And also, you know, like it was good for us because we did kind of like inherit some of the free marketing, because mm-hmm. You know, people are used to that place being a garden shop, mm-hmm. so it's easy for them to kind of see it as a garden shop. Again, we had like customers coming in who didn't even like notice it would change ownership. It's just like, oh, like did y'all just like, you know, renamed yourself, or like, you know, like what happened, you know, like yeah. Some of them might not even notice, like it looked different too, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in that way, it was like a really nice way to start a business. And that is also why we kind of pushed through, even though it was a big risk. It just seemed like it was such a good opportunity. And, you know, like in business school, I never went through business school, but I read a lot of business books and, you know, kind of dropped in on some business class. You know, that's kind of a number one advice, is like kind of seize the opportunity, you know, and it's all about kind of timing a lot of your larger business decisions when the opportunity kind of presents themselves.
So how does that business relate to the other business? Is it that a landscaping client, you can get the plants that you have in your nursery for them, or someone is potentially there buying plants and they say, I need help with landscaping. Like, talk to me about that, like the integration of the different business or services.
Yeah. So that's a great question. That was definitely one of the reasons that we wanted a garden shop. We were planning to have a garden shop eventually. For that kind of vertical integration, you know, again, the very typical business school kind of strategy to reduce costs, reduce labor, because we were, as a landscaping company, was just operating out of our house. What that means is, like, a lot of time when we need to get plants, we have to kind of just go drive around the town, different nurseries, pick up plants, you know, that's a lot of time sink. And that also means the plants cost more too, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to now we get them in bulk. And that makes it, you know, a lot cheaper for us internally. So that integration definitely help in a very logistical and like clear way. And then there's the marketing integration too, you know. It's like the landscaping, you know, gets more exposure just from having a physical presence, mm-hmm. too, and then vice versa too, you know. The garden shop gets extra revenues because we have a landscaping business that constantly buys plants from the garden shop directly. So there is a lot of synergy, a symbiotic relationship, if you mm-hmm. will. And that, you know, it's a continual theme that kind of runs not only just like the things that we believe in, but also like how we kind of practice our business too.
So for people who don't know about a worker co-op, tell me more about that. Is it that the people who are working in the store are owners of the business as well? And then how do you determine who might be doing landscaping versus who might be doing something in the nursery?
Yeah, so it's first I want to say, like, every worker co-op runs differently. At the base level, what a worker co-op is defined as is that each worker has a path to ownership, and once you know, go through whatever requirements, they become an equal share owner. And that's kind of the key of, like, difference between a employee-owned company as opposed to a worker-owned cooperative. The cooperative parts specifically define that each owner is a equal vote.
Versus an employee who has potential ownership interest, it would not be equal. It would
exactly.
be that their employer would be a significant owner and they would have, you know, a couple of percentages. So is it that, I guess this is kind of a weird question, but how do people afford to live that work there? Is it that they get paid hourly? Is it that, there's some sort of ownership draw? Like, talk about.
Yeah. So, eventually, you know, like, again, we're still, like, we're not even year three yet. So eventually, once we turn in a good amount of profits, then the profit can be distributed equally to the, you know, the owners. And that also means that each owner's stake does, like, have a share, you know, like, of the potential, like, what's the word here? Like, assets of the company too. After, you know, we pay off the loans and all of that, you know. I'm drawing a blank right now.
So do they not see any money until that point, or is it that you're still able to hire people now and, you know, they're hired as if they were hired at any other thing, but they're on a path to ownership, so that's the difference.
Yeah, so everyone still gets paid, whether owner or not, a market rate wage, and you know, that's just, yeah, like you said, people still need to live, whether they are an owner or not, but on top of that, there is a potential for actual distribution of profits. And what's interesting about specifically worker cooperative, and if you really want to look into tax law like that, the profit distribution within a worker-owned cooperative is specifically called a patronage, and it's not taxed in the same way that a different kind of company that's not a worker cooperative, how they distribute their profit. That profit gets taxed twice. You know, there is a income tax and then there is a capital gain tax. For the patronage, it's taxed just once. And that's just an aside thing. Not that
that's fascinating.
Not that we're even making that much money. Not that anyone's even getting any profit, because we're still just barely breaking even, you know? So, to answer your question, like, everyone gets paid a wage right now, and then the eligibility to become a worker owner is you have to work a certain amount of hours, a certain amount of time, and then you have to get, you know, a few existing worker owner vouch for you. You have to go through worker owner trainings, and then you have to meet a set of requirements that are written, you know, that are stated in our bylaw, and then you basically get voted in by the existing worker owners, and then we kind of just expand our worker owner body slowly that way.
And how many people do you have, and how many people do you want to have? Is there some sort of limit or cap?
There isn't cap. The conventional wisdom of other worker cooperative is that you want to aim to have all of your workers to become worker owners. as much as possible. Because what you don't want is to have this essentially a class divide, right? Like literally you have like people who own the company and then people who don't. Mm-hmm. And that's not...
Working next to each other.
Yeah, working next to each other. And that could work, but even that mental divide it eventually kind of can grow into like an actual substantial material divide, whether that's through like differences in terms of, oh, well, if you're not an owner, you don't get profit sharing. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, you're not an owner, you don't actually have an ultimate say in terms of where the company is going, larger policy decisions and whatnot. Or like the other direction, you know, because I've been talking about perks, but there's also responsibilities as an owner. It's actually a lot of responsibility. It's like you are responsible for the lease of the building. You know, you're responsible for paying off the loans. You're responsible for making sure the company is actually run in a way that's beneficial for the entire collective, not just yourself.
You know? So the worker owners, in a sense, have like a personal guarantee so that their own personal liability is at stake for all these things you're mentioning.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the good thing is, because it's a lot of people, ideally, right? Then that liability gets spread out. And that's kind of the beauty of like a worker cooperative, is that when you have like kind of distributed liability, distributed responsibilities, then you can try to work the company and govern the company in a way as democratically as possible, instead of kind of a top-down thing. Because when you have, you know, one person with a huge amount of disproportional liability, then they feel like they have to have more power because of that. And that's, you know, you can argue that's a reasonable thing to do, and you know, so logistically it's good to try to distribute that risk and liability and responsibility so that we can run things more democratically. And we can talk about what that means, because like when you look at different sizes of worker co-ops, there are worker co-ops that are just like less than a dozen people, and then you can just have weekly meetings where you just talk about things and then make decisions, you know, that way. Or you have worker co-ops, you know, the largest worker co-ops in the world is Mondragon. It's in Spain. It's got 10,000 people.
Wow.
And, you know, so 10,000 owners, and then even more people who are not owners yet, of course. And how do they make decisions? They certainly cannot just have weekly meetings where 10,000 people just come together and make large drawn out arguments about how to move forward on minute details of the operations, you know.
So because everybody's an owner, not everybody, the workers who gain the ownership, is it that it's kind of like a board, they're all voting on things to do or how to move forward? What happens if they don't want someone to be involved? Or is there a possibility of a buyout? Like, do sort of partnership things translate into co-op things? So could we say, you know, this person is causing the business to lose profit, or this person is not doing any of the work that they signed up for? We need to, I'm going to say vote them off the island, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. That's a great question. And that's something that nobody wants to think about, but you have to have a kind of a backup plan for. In an ideal world, we want to be, you know, we want to welcome everybody, you know. But at the end of the day, like, there are specific things, bottom lines, whether that's financial bottom line or like value bottom line, there are a set of values that we all really believe in. And if there is a worker owner that's not continuously violating those values, we do have procedures where we can like essentially vote to like remove that ownership from them, and essentially fire them from the company. And in that case, legally, that means the company will buy out that share. from the person. And yeah, like it's actually something that when I talk to other people who are trying to start their own co-op or just communities, I really want them to think about, like, okay, how do you let someone go? Because it's a very important question to have. You can't just be kind of like a very utopian thinking mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, everyone's just going to get along. It's just not going to happen. Certainly not until everyone kind of unlearns like all of the toxic stuff that we have learned yeah. through the kind of, you know, like larger systemic issues that we have all kind of being raised in. So,
well, and it's a business, it's relationship oriented, but there's also an operational business that you have to think of.
Yes.
So that requires making decisions about people or their plans or things working or not working. So if you just do that, like, oh, well, it's okay that Sarah's not doing any work because she's great, that's going to translate into the co-op potentially losing money or not making money.
Yeah. Totally. And it depends on like how big and, you know, where that decision point is depends on how big we grow too. Let's say, you know, if we grow to, let's say like Walmart size, which, you know, like I want to say like it's possible, but I also don't want to be like, oh yeah, we're definitely going to be like Walmart. But like, you know, if we grow to that size, then we would have enough money to like every now and then just like have like, you know, like some positions where people are kind of just like, I don't want to say they're not doing anything, but they have just more freedom to kind of take different risks that doesn't always have to make revenue, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And this is the kind of conversation we even have at a larger society level. Like, yeah, we need to have safety net for people who might not be typically productive, so to mm-hmm. speak, in the society. But as a society, we adopted this value where like we just need to take care of people because we have the capacity to. Mm-hmm. So why not? Right. But, you know, at our scale, which even with 30 people, it's still a very much kind of a working class business where, you know, like retail, there's not that much margins of profit. Landscaping, there's not that much margin of profit. So like, we don't have that kind of capacity to just take on people and kind of just have them just be on the payroll, but, you know, mm-hmm. not actually contributing to the revenue in any way.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there people though that do different things? So, you know, some might do the retail component. Someone else might be a graphic designer or, you know, marketing. You know, you can still kind of utilize people's creativity.
Yeah, so there is definitely division of labor. We are very much like, you know, like technical oriented, you know, like whatever people are good at. And if that matches with like what their passion is, we really want to put people in that role because that increases the efficiency of our operation, but only if like, you know, that role actually serves the company, right? Because like, you know, like we actually have a lot of very talented graphic designers, you know, in the company, but like
you don't need 15
we involved, don't need yeah. even like two graphic yeah. designers, you know, so at this point we don't even have one graphic designer. It's more just like every now and then when something does need like a little bit tweak, you know, we kind of give it to someone, whether that's me, whether that's, you know, someone else on the marketing team, or whether it's like, you know, one of our shop worker is like actually really good at, you know, graphic design, you know, like, unfortunately she's not getting paid the market designer rate because she's a shop worker, most of the time, but you know, like she's still like very graciously tried to contribute mm-hmm. her time, you know, and that's like part of the culture too, is like everyone have a set role, but are also down to just help out wherever they can. And we also kind of build that in a little bit. We do cross train people here and there just so that there is a little bit more movement that's possible within the company. And as we grow bigger, of course, we can allow even more movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I really like is that you wear your values on your sleeve. Like you go there, you know, it's about community, you know, it's about diversity. you know that, you know, you're not compromising social justice, and that, so I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of businesses who lean into their values. I wanted to talk to you about the community component. You know, mm-hmm. you are doing events with children, people of all ages, drag queens, you're having music, you're having art, you have a marketplace there of candles and crafts and things like that. Like, talk to me about not just the nursery component, but the creation of a community that includes events and a variety of people.
Yeah, yeah. So we do, we have been starting to growing capacities to do that kind of events, community events, whether it's like classes, workshops, free concerts. We actually have another holiday free concerts coming up next Friday. And and that's been great. I also want to throw in, like, we have a lot of community partners with like local nonprofits doing things kind of behind the scene that people don't really see. Like, we have kind of a monthly fundraiser, like that's more hourly visible, but even that we don't really advertise that much. It's kind of just kind of in the background, just kind of running. And then there are other like community projects that you know, our landscaping side do with like nonprofits, you know, installing things in like, you know, neighborhoods that, you know, often don't get as much like nice, pretty landscape care. So things like that. We have a project that should be coming up soon with like the elementary school of that particular neighborhood. So we're going to try to kind of help them ramp up their like student garden too. So there are a lot of community projects, and we really want to do more of that. And that has to, of course, be kind of following us like actually becoming more sustainable on a financial level too, and on a time level, because like everyone is still kind of overworked a little bit, but not in the same way that your typical small business owner overworks, you know, because that's still like, you know, 60-80 hour work week kind of thing. Nobody is doing 60, even close to 60 hour work week on a consistent level at this point, except for like maybe like one or two people who, unfortunately, they are just like the more experienced and have more skill sets. So so like that, until they can kind of train other people to do these things, which we are doing, and then like you know, they do sometimes voluntarily work a little bit more just so that we can kind of take care of the rest of the workers. But yeah, getting back to building community, that is a big part of it. And we have larger plans for doing even more concrete things. Like I said, you know, I personally define community as sharing resources and sharing goals. Like, you know, free concerts is great, but we want to do even more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And, you know, that's an example of being a business. Not only do you have a creative business model with the co-op, worker co-op model, but then you're also incorporating the community and making community partnerships. So I think that's wonderful. I applaud you for that. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your love of plants and ecosystem and things like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you as a child, is this something like from a long time ago? Is there something that you can remember where you're thinking about, you know, walking down the street thinking like, what is the ecosystem here? What is my role in the world? Like, tell me a little bit more about how you came to being the person you are.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I grew up very fascinated with nature, but not in the way that biologists do, because I was more interested in physics part of the nature, and that was like from a very early age on. And by the way, just like a side note, I grew up in Shanghai, China, and didn't really move to the United States until I was 15. So growing up in Shanghai, it's kind of a concrete jungle. It's like scrapers, like, doesn't end until the horizon, you know, that kind of, like, you know, the fifth element vibe, you know, kind of giant metropolis. It's not very often for me to even see a wildlife. It's not very often for me to see, like, different type of plants. So I wasn't actually at all fascinated with ecology, plants, or animals. I was mostly fascinated about the universe, stars, black holes, you know, time travel, just like interesting physics things, because that's what I learned from some of the books that were gifted to me. And at a very, very early age, around, I want to say, like, certainly when I was like 10 or 11, I already just, like, set my life goal at the time. Like, I was like, I want to be a physicist. That's what I want to do. And that's what I went to college for, too.
And just a 10-year-old learning about physics.
Just learning about physics. I was just like, but, you know, like, nothing, like, actually hard, but just the fun part, right? Yeah. Not the actual mathy part. I tried to do that, but I was like, wow, that's like, I don't even, there's not even numbers when
you're talking to your mom about acceleration rates.
Yeah, yeah.
And momentum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But at some point, that converged with biology and ecology, and it's an interesting convergence, and the co-op helped a lot with that, and it was living in the student co-op in Santa Barbara and in Berkeley. There is a convergence of, like, hard physics science and computer science and engineering, and then you have softer, I don't want to say softer, it's like biology, ecologies that some of my friends were into, because they were very much into creating food forests, creating habitats and whatever else. And then the third part, which is human system, like the actual co-ops that I was living in, and how all of those systems kind of converge. And I basically had a continuous light bulbs just going off, where it's like, all of these systems share very similar patterns, especially ones that are sustainable. And that's kind of like how I personally got into learning more about ecology, learning more about biology in college, like on my own. Like, literally, I was skipping physics classes so I can just read biology and ecology textbooks, which, like, I don't know why anybody would do that, but that's what I did. So I was very much into ecology, and I still am, and I'm working on, like, a book, essentially kind of like tying up all of those things together and really talking about different applicable design patterns that we can use to apply to creating human systems that we learn from physical and biological systems. And I want to say, this is nothing new. I didn't invent any of these things. These are things that's been around for a long time, whether through, you know, academic histories, but also, like, human histories and indigenous histories and natural histories, even before human. Like, all of that's been around for a long time, and I'm just fortunate enough to kind of see all of that and trying to kind of tie them together.
Yeah, it's wonderful that the convergence was there. And then what's really great is now you have a business that is taking who you are as a person and your values, and it's combining that with your passions, and then it's combining that with your business acumen as well. So we're sort of merging all those things together.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, I mean, we tend to care more about the business we're involved with, because
yes,
it's an extension of us. You know, it's an extension of who we are and what we want to be. And so you're building that. And I say, for my business, I say, you know, I'm building business, but I'm also building community.
Mm-hmm.
So you're giving the world that thought process or those passions, and you're working with other people to make a better space around you, a better community around you.
Mm-hmm.
So five questions for you.
Okay.
So the first one is, what's a quote or mantra that you live by?
That's, I love that question. it's actually something that I think a lot about. But anyway, let me tell you what it is. It's actually, it's seek truth and nurture life. I try to create this very simple things that kind of exemplifies the things that I believe in, but also Symbiote believes in, and then a lot of people that I work with and live with believe in. And the way to think about that is that these are actions, right? These are two actions, two processes that kind of feed back into each other. And feedback loops are, we don't really have time to talk about that, but it's a very core design patterns in ecology and in sustainable systems. So you have this feedback loop of seeking truth. So finding out what's true, not only just in the universe, but also within yourself, within your own community, within your relationship with each other, and using that truth to, again, nurture life. So that means creating, helping people, helping other animals, helping plants, helping your ecosystems, but and also help yourself too. You know, you are part of life. So nurturing that kind of life in ways that have to be, of course, informed by understanding how that actually works. So that feedback loop is something that I personally believe in that works as a really good model. But also, when you actually dig into the evolution of biology, the evolution of any or organism, you can actually see like that's actually a very fundamental strategy that a lot of organism takes on in their evolutionary history. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I like that how you're combining it also to science, but also to yourself. So, and it makes me think of the most authentic people are the people who are truthful about who they are. And then I also think about falsifiability with science and how there's a constant desire to falsify to get to the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it, in a people perspective, it says, like, don't be phony.
Yes.
Like, be who you really are. What's your favorite childhood memory?
Oh, wow. What are my favorite childhood memory? Oh my God. My favorite childhood memory, it's, I have a lot of them, but there was a period of time in middle school and I was in China. Somehow I got into super, like became very disciplined, and I was waking up like 2 hours before school. She's like, who does that in middle school? But I did.
Someone who reads physics books when they're 10.
Well, funny enough, I wasn't trying to study. I was just trying to get really good at basketball because I was super into basketball at the time. I'm just like, I'm going to wake up, get to school, you know, an hour to two earlier than is usual, you know, starting time, so I can just practice basketball on my own to get really good at it. Yeah, so that was like quite intense, but I also just was really fun, really exhilarating.
How long did that go on for? I mean,
I want to say like half a year. So like, you know, it's not like that long, but when you were, you know, like 13, that's pretty long.
Yeah. That's a lot to say, because when you're 12 or 13, I mean, you don't want to get out of bed, and especially in the morning. So
yeah.
You were like, I'm there. I'm out. I'm up. I'm ready. I'm playing basketball.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's a failure or a mistake that made you good or actually turned out for the best? So what's something that happened that you're like, okay, well, that worked out.
Interesting. I want to say like just about every single failure that I've had is like a good lesson. I mean, obviously that's like a pretty cliched wisdom at this point, but I want to say, there are so many failures. Oh my God. Okay, we can get a little bit personal here. I want to say, like, there are things that I learned from, like, maybe a previous failed, like, you know, romantic relationship where, like, it felt so catastrophically that I kind of learned, like, oh, like, there are so many things that I need to unlearn in ways how I communicate with people so that I don't get to a point where people like don't want to communicate with me. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, just like building that trust, building that, you know, whatever has more to do with intention. Like, cause like everyone knows, like I have good intentions. Like no one ever doubts that, but it's just like some of my communication patterns that I had to kind of unlearn in order for people to feel like more at ease and feel more open, was like kind of a, you know, more open to talk to me about difficult topic.
Yeah, that's good. That's very reflective. What issue or issues keep you up at night?
Oh my God. You know, it would be too cliche to say climate change, honestly. Although climate change doesn't actually keep me up at night as much as just our business, because it's so much more immediate and you know, as a very kind of number centric person, you know, like until we get to a point where we're like sustainably profitable, I'm just gonna be consistently anxious to like try to grow the business to a point where like we're sustainably profitable and we're paying people living wage. And, you know, like we're not there yet. You know, it's just like market rate wage, but like market rate wage is not living wage, unfortunately.
And what are you reading or watching these days?
Let's see. I have a giant to read list of ecology, mostly ecology papers, physics papers. I unfortunately don't really have a lot of time to read like books because they're just too long a lot of time. But I do like a good science fiction novel. And I've been trying to read The Fifth Season for a long time. It's a relatively new sci-fi that has been out for like 3 or 4 years now. Pretty boring stuff. Yeah, sciencey stuff.
Reading papers.
Yep. Reading research papers. Yeah, it's not fun.
It's fun for you, so that's what's important.
It's once I actually understand that, then it's fun.
Yeah.
It is fun.
We do things that other people don't think are fun. Like I watch Supreme Court justice hearings.
Oh, yeah.
And January 6th insurrection hearings. And I read about policy and I watch every political debate. Ooh. So,
yeah,
you know, I do stuff like that, that people are like, nope, not doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the last part of this is there anybody in the community you want to give a shout out to? And then how do people find you for your nursery, your community, your landscaping, all of the things?
Yeah. I mean, giving a shout out to all of my coworkers, y'all are kicking ass. I mean, it's just like the amount of commitment and then the amount of work that people go through, and then the amount of not just like actual, like, you know, like day-to-day work, but actual emotional work, because creating a co-op in a, you know, kind of a more hierarchical society is very, very difficult, because we have to unlearn so many things that we don't even know. Like, it's not just as simple as like, oh, let's just have like, you know, democratic voting system. It's not as simple as that. And so I just want to give a shout out to, yeah, all of my coworkers. I almost want to just name all of them, because they're so awesome. And just the amount of, dedications is just unparalleled to anything that I see. It's if there is a thing that gives me hope to humanity, that's it. Yeah.
That's very kind. And the world needs more businesses like yours and business owners like yours, or like you. I can't talk. You made me emotional. No. And then how do people find you? So how do people become a client of one of the services or products that you offer, either through your landscaping or through the nursery itself?
Yeah, so the easiest way would be going onto our website, symbiop.com. That's S-Y-M-B-I-O-P.com. It's kind of a weird word. We didn't actually get into this. It's actually kind of a combining the word symbiosis and cooperative into one word. S-Y-M-B-I-O-P.com. There you can find our landscaping, you know, materials and portfolios and our practices, but also our garden shop. It has an online store that's also at that site that people can just browse through things that you can that they can buy and they can, you know, order it and then pick up in store. So yeah,
very cool. Wonderful to reconnect with you, and yeah, thank you for doing my podcast. And thank you for inspiring me. I think it's inspiring what you're doing, so I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about things that inspires me, you know. So it's, yeah, and what y'all do here is great. I think there should be more avenue for, you know, like people to talk about businesses and, you know, especially small businesses, because I really think there's a need for more people, more entrepreneurs, more people who care enough about something to like get things going and like, you know, like and take care of each other.
Very cool. Well, have a good night. Take care. You probably, like me, have more work to do tonight. Whether or not it happens or not.
Fortunately, no. I mean, I might have to send out like one email maybe. But yeah, thank you, and you have a good night too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much.